I'm Anita Lustria, and this is Faith Conversations. Today on the podcast, I am thrilled to be talking about loving my actual neighbor. What on earth does that mean? We give lip service to it. I mean, my church's tagline is love God, love neighbor. But are we doing it? What does it really mean if we are doing it? And so today I get to talk with Alexandra Kuykendall. And of course, this is me. You all know this. I forgot to ask how to pronounce Alexandra's last name, but I think I did it correctly, but maybe not. Alexandra?
Well, a lot of people who spell it that way do pronounce it.
But you don't.
But our family, and I married into this name, so I take no responsibility, we pronounce it Kuykendall as if there is an R. There is no R. There is no reason why you would know that unless you speak Dutch.
As soon as I said it, I'm like, I know this is wrong. I just know this is wrong. I do this all the time. I get the first name right. I ask about that, but then I forget to ask about the second name.
Well, I was even at the airport last week, and someone picked up my bag, and I could tell he didn't want to try the name, so he handed my bag to somebody else. And I said, he didn't want to even try it, did it? Did he? And she said, no.
That's great. So, I love it.
I don't blame you.
So basically, you've just been introduced without the big formal introduction. So let me just go back and forth with you about who you are. Number one, you're the author of Loving My Actual Neighbor. And what's kind of cool, and I didn't realize this, I guess I had missed these other books, but you've written a couple of other books with, you know, Loving My Actual in the title. So what are they about?
Well, Loving My Actual Life is really a book about contentment.
Nice.
And it is geared, because so much of it is from my own life as a mom of four, towards moms, I would say. Those are the people who really resonate with it most, because all the stories have to do with the chaos of kids. And expectations. It's a book, all of these books are a little bit about expectations and realizing that we have them as we are disappointed in how life doesn't quite unfold the way that we think it will. So really that book is about, I would say, motherhood and being in the middle of it. And then Loving My Actual Christmas.
Talk about expectations, right?
Yes. Woo. And I say it's for the Christmas orchestrators, and that tends to be women. I'll just make a blanket statement there. So women have really resonated with that book. I mean, in a crazy way. And that really has resonated with women much older than me too, which has surprised me, because so many of them, that's the time when they see their kids or their grandkids, and the expectations are so high, and the stakes feel like, I've been planning this all year, and this is not how I thought it was going to go.
I talked with a mom last Christmas of older kids. My son is 26, married for a year and a half, and so I was talking to another mom with not yet married kids, but that, you know, post-high school, all post-high school kids in college and beyond. So, and yes, huge expectations that did not meet what she thought would be, and really struggled through that. So I get that it would resonate with the older than you set, because you're 40-something, I'm guessing.
Yes, I'm in my 40s, and I'm in the full swing of parenting. But really, I had younger moms in mind when I was writing it.
Interesting.
So they have loved it, too, because it has a lot of practical sections in the back just about how to set up Christmas traditions in a way that in 10 years you're not resenting them.
Yes.
You know, kind of the blueprint, because it's easier when you're starting out with your family to set boundaries than it is
later.
Later.
Right on. And I'm also thinking, you know, you've got families of divorce, and, you know, there's all kinds of families that I think could benefit from something like that.
Yes. So. It is a wonderful book. I loved writing it. Christmas can be a very painful time for people.
Yes.
And as I've been around the country speaking on it, that is what keeps coming up, is part of why Christmas is so hard is because if there's a part of your life that is difficult, it feels especially hard during the holidays, and we carry that. So anyway, I love that book because I do think it has resonated with people.
Nice. Well, before we get to loving my actual neighbor, which is the content of what we're going to really center in on and talk about today, you already mentioned your four kids, and I know you're married to Derek, and you're in the Denver area in Colorado. How old are your children now? And I also realized as I was reading the book, all four are daughters.
Yes.
Oh, mm-hmm. Man, I'm thinking of weddings, and I'm sure people say that all the time, and just college in general and weddings, but how old are they now?
They range from 7 to 16.
Wow, okay.
So we're in that group. We're at three different schools. I just came straight from the first grade, books and bagels morning, and so it is a zoo, but all of our kids live with, they all live with us, but they all go to school with it a mile and a half of our home.
That helps.
Live in the city, and they're in city schools, and it really creates this beautiful sense of community, not just because of the relationships, but just because of proximity.
Yes.
And I know where they are, and I can get to them quickly if I need to, which I don't really ever need to, but just the feeling.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good. So we love being in the city. We are city folk.
And were you always city folk, or have you become city folk? Because one of my first questions, I think it's always interesting why we write about what we do. Mm-hmm. There's some hook that's about us. It's not, I've run across all these people and I thought I would write on this topic. Generally not the case. There's some real internal reason why we write about what we do. And so I'm sure that's the case with loving my actual neighbor. And so maybe fold into that response, have you always been city people?
Well, I would say my husband, no, and me, yes.
Oh, interesting. Okay. I was thinking probably the other way around for some reason.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
I grew up with a single mom, and we traveled all over the world, but mostly we were based in Seattle. Mm. And my middle school and high school years, I was there, and it was at the very end of the segregation busing stuff that was happening in Seattle. And so for middle school, I was bused to the other side of town.
Okay.
And then for high school, I was in my neighborhood, but people from that neighborhood
were bused
to me.
Okay.
And so my high school experience, I would say, this is very approximate, was about a third Asian, a third Black, and a third white.
Okay.
And so I went to a private liberal arts college after high school, and I realized how rich of a high school and childhood experience I had, because I had a lot of international travel.
Yes.
But then even in my own high school and my friend group, I had such a rich diversity of kids who were children of immigrants, kids who were living in public housing, and I was being raised by a single mom who was a teacher. I mean, we just had all kinds of different life experiences, and I thought, I really appreciate this, and I didn't appreciate it until I was in a new setting where I realized most of my classmates here in college really had a very homogeneous high school experience, which I'm learning is more the norm, I think, in our country than the exception.
Well, and I'll use the word privilege. Often that is more the norm, I would think, too.
Right. There's so much choice that's involved in it.
Yeah.
So my husband grew up outside of Denver in Boulder, which was a pretty homogenous community there, a college town. And he got very interested, I think partly through basketball, because he was exposed to some urban experiences as a basketball star, to just kids living in different communities and different scenarios. And so he studied sociology in college, and he went to the same school I did. But afterwards, we both worked for Young Life in their urban training program in Colorado Springs.
Oh, my husband started in Young Life. He actually started Young Life for Young Life in Nevada. It had never existed in Nevada. So, obviously this is years ago.
Oh, that's a whole interesting different demographic.
Yes. I would think. Yeah. And then went to the Chicago area after that. But anyway.
Yeah. Well, so we worked for the Dale House Project, was the urban training part of Young Life for a number of years.
Wonderful.
And that is where we met and started dating. So we had this shared passion of kids just who had come from kind of rough experiences.
Yep.
Anyway, long story, we decided this was kind of the path for our family. We moved into, and I start talking about this in the book, we moved into our neighborhood that we're in now when we moved from Portland, Oregon, partly because I was a Spanish speaker and we wanted to be in a community where I could practice my Spanish.
How did you grow? I mean, how did you become a Spanish speaker? Well, I mean, was that a college major or did your mom speak it? Or yeah, what's the
all
deal?
All of that. All of that. So my dad was from Spain.
Wow. Okay.
From Barcelona. And so I spent a lot of my childhood going to visit him.
Wow.
Okay. But he actually spoke Catalan at home. He didn't speak Spanish, which, you know, that's just
right. It's its own
Barcelona trivia. And but because of my international travels, I was really interested in languages, and I ended up being a Spanish major in college, as was my mother.
Wow.
So
okay.
I just kind of followed in her footsteps that way. And really, it was because it was easy for me. So that's why I chose that major.
I mean, brilliant. I think I might have done the same thing. Okay. Wow. So, and when you moved into your current neighborhood, more urban, this is, mm-hmm. had you had any kids yet? Or I think you were pregnant with your first, right?
We were pregnant with our first. And we had moved from a similar neighborhood in Portland. I would say the Portland neighborhood we were in was gentrifying, is the term that's thrown around. Quite quickly, we were part of that.
And for someone who's not familiar with that term, just say what that is.
Sure. It's when a traditionally poor neighborhood becomes more popular with people who come from maybe middle class, upper middle class backgrounds, often because it's affordable and it's in the city. And it tends to happen in urban areas, but gentrification can happen in the suburbs or mm-hmm. the country. And then housing prices go up as the demographics of the neighborhood change. And so people who have traditionally lived in that neighborhood get pushed out because they can no longer afford to pay the housing costs. So we were in the middle of that swirl in Portland, and we came to Denver, and we wanted to live in the city. We wanted to live close to my in-laws. So geographically, we had a part of town we were interested in. And we were interested in being in a place where our kids would be exposed to some Spanish. And so we chose the neighborhood we did, and that was 17 years ago, almost. And the neighborhood has changed dramatically in the last 17 years, as many urban neighborhoods have. And we are now surrounded by a lot of hipsters, and Denver's housing, just in general, the cost has just skyrocketed in the last 10 years.
Wow.
And my husband works in affordable housing here, and so it's just part of our daily conversation about how expensive it is to live here.
Wow.
But as a result, our neighbors have changed
right
in the last 17 years because of who can afford to be here.
Which I'm sure that's a conversation that you have as well. You know, one of the reasons you moved in there was probably for diversity, and not to mention proximity to in-laws, but some of these other issues that have radically shifted in the last 10 years, I think you said, because mm-hmm. of gentrification in your area. And yet your husband is still working in this affordable housing field near where you live, mm-hmm. trying to...
Yeah. In the city core,
yeah,
right where we are. And it's hard. I mean, pretty much nothing in Denver is affordable anymore. So that term even gets people riled up, like, affordable, who can afford
right.
it? And yet it is a real, real need. And so he works specifically with people who are coming directly off the street. People who are living in transition, what they call transitional housing, which is often pretty much subsidized.
Yes.
And then they also own some long-term affordable housing properties, apartment buildings. And that is really intended for people to be able to stay in the community again.
Right.
That is their support system, because if they have just become sober, started counseling, become part of a church, are seeing a mental health psychiatrist, you know, all of their doctors, medical needs, are all within a certain neighborhood or city, to pull them out of that, it pulls apart the support structure that they've just created to create a stable life. And right. so it is a discussion that cities around the country are having, and we're certainly having it here in Denver.
Well, and bottom line, in some ways, you know, to the reading of your book and the writing of it, where we are in many ways doesn't matter. The question on the table here is, what does it look like to love my actual neighbor? Who is our actual neighbor? We get into these conversations in scripture about, you know, the Good Samaritan and who, you know, who is our neighbor. But I love that amplifier there, the actual, loving my actual neighbor. And so I think this topic is very important. Why do you believe it's so important today? Because I think many people have trouble connecting with their actual neighbor. If we're followers of Christ, we're going to church, which may or may not be in our actual neighborhood.
Right.
And we love connecting with those people because they're like us in many ways. At least a belief system, value system, etc. But let's start talking about why you wrote this book and why and who God calls us to connect with, and some of the whys of that as you talk about in the book.
Well, I think the big thing that really caught my attention was the last presidential election, and what I realized in all of that is that I was living in an echo chamber, thinking that I wasn't.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I follow a lot of people who think differently than I do on purpose, intentionally. Like, I'm intentionally trying to get new voices into my world. And when that happened, I realized I have not done a good job at this. But I also thought, what about the way that we're talking to each other and about things is different today than it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago? And the more I looked at this big macro issue, the more I had to look at the micro and the one-on-one relationships and interactions we have. And the more I looked at it, the more the trends were obvious. That we surround ourselves, not just in our information, but in our actual lives, with people who think like us, look like us, talk like us, believe like us, consciously and unconsciously. And so I had to look at my own life and say, how am I doing this? How well am I doing at being in relationships with people who think, live, look, sound different than me? Because as we've already covered, my husband and I live in a pretty diverse place on purpose. Like, we are very intentional people. And yet, when I think of the people who live right around me, and I do have pretty diverse neighbors still. I mean, we have a lot of neighbors that have stayed. They own their homes and they've been able to stay. How well do I know them? Mm-hmm. How well do I know the parents at the school that don't have a college education? We have very diverse schools. And yet I tend to be in conversations with people who are also going to the mountains for the weekend, or whatever example that shows that my life is a life that looks a certain way and theirs doesn't reflect it. So it was in that place of self-examination that I thought, I am not the only one that is experiencing this. And if we focus in on the micro, the macro has to get better. Mm. If we each focus in on that group of people that is within arm's reach, that is how the country will change. And that is how culturally we'll change. And here's the thing. As a follower of Christ, I believe we have an exceptional calling to this that is maybe different than our neighbors who aren't believers, who aren't Christians in this, because Jesus is so clear about this, that we don't have an option to opt out.
I like that. We don't have an option to opt out. He is that clear. I loved, I'm a big lover of quotes, loved the quote at the very beginning. I mean, you know, at the top of, the front of your introduction. It's a C.S. Lewis quote. Who doesn't love a C.S. Lewis quote? I had never heard this one before, which I can't believe. I've read Mere Christianity, which is where this is from, but obviously it's been a while, and it did not connect with me back then. You included this. Do not waste time bothering whether you love your neighbor. Act as if you did. As soon as we do this, we find one of the great secrets. When you are behaving as if you loved someone, you will presently come to love them. And I was transported to my senior year in high school when this freshman girl just followed me around and kind of poked at me and drove me crazy. I woke up one morning and I said, all right, just love her. Just love her. Just respond positively and love her. And by golly, if my attitude didn't change toward this young gal. And so I love this C.S. Lewis quote, and man, we could use a lot more of that, because I don't think we live that way. Even those of us that know Christ, follow him, love him, I don't think we live that way. So number one, thank you for that, for transporting mm-hmm. me. But let's move on to what you do in the book, which I think is very helpful. You talk about a variety of practices. I'm a spiritual director, so I love talking about spiritual practices. Honestly, you could label these as spiritual practices easily. These are practices that you focus in on that help us move toward. I'm curious, you know, how you came up with these, how you kind of distilled these down to the practices that you added into the book.
Well, I was thinking about all this stuff, right? And knew I wanted to write a book about it. But I thought, okay, what does the church really need from me specifically? You know, whenever you're writing a book, you think no idea is unique in the world.
Right.
And except through your eyes. We live in a unique time.
Yeah.
So that's true. That maybe this is a unique time for me to write this. And what do I uniquely have to say about this?
Right.
And so I started talking to people here in the Denver area that I think do a good job of loving their neighbors because of their faith. That they were all Christians. They all were people that I thought, I want to be more like him or her. And so I took them out to coffee and I started interviewing people. And I started hearing some trends of things that people said, you know, if the church, and I just use that as kind of a broad term, if the church did this better, we would be loving our neighbors in a better way. So one of the people I went out to lunch with was my friend Karen Parks, who worked at MOPS with me for a long time. And what's
MOPS, for those that don't know?
Oh, okay. MOPS is Mothers of Preschoolers, and it's an international ministry that's through churches, through the local church, to outreach to moms in the community, specifically moms of young kids. And I was on staff there for almost 10 years and did a lot of writing. And that's why a lot of my earlier writing, especially, is geared towards moms, because that was my audience. And Karen and I were out to lunch, and I said, you know, just talking to her about all of this. And she said, there are some verses in the first chapter of 2 Peter that I don't think get enough attention. And she pointed them out to me, and I went home and I looked at them, and it was as if all of these conversations kind of illuminated. And I thought, there is something here that I think is where God is pushing me. And out of that came these seven practices. So it's part scripture informed, part life informed. I like to say that I'm a kitchen anthropologist.
I love that term. That's a good one.
That I stand in my kitchen and I try to figure out the world and what God wants me to do in it.
Yep.
And that's where I felt like these practices came from. And you know, they are not complicated. They are simple, but they are not easy. And that is why we have to practice them.
Yes.
Because we have to go to these places. They are not necessarily our natural places. For some, they are. And I will say, you know, a few of the practices come more easily to me than others, whereas some of the other practices come more easily to my friends.
Yeah.
But we have to be intentional about them. And that's kind of where they stemmed from. And so there's seven of them. And Karen's thing was, they point us to a sustainable way to love our neighbors, because often in the church, we like have a campaign or a moment of guilt where we think, I want to do a better job of loving my neighbors. And she has a point there.
Yes. That brilliant.
We are meant to love our neighbors really as a lifestyle.
Sustainable way. I love that.
And so this is a way that God has showed us. I mean, he shows us over and over and over again in scripture. These aren't the only verses that point to how we're to love our neighbors, but this was just a unique framework that I always want to offer people practical ways to carry out something in a way that they can do no matter their external circumstances. And so I believe these practices are doable. I say, whether you're in a prison cell or a boardroom, these are not circumstance specific. And again, that comes from where I live and my community. I always want things that feel doable no matter what your living situation is. I think these are.
And no matter, I'll add in, no matter what your season of life, you might have children who are ages 7 to 16, and someone else listening might be like me, an empty nester. Yes, add that in, no matter what season of life you're in as well. I love that. I really appreciate that. I think we need to dig in and talk about specifically some of these practices. So I'll let you take us to where you want to go first. You know, we're not going to, we might get to mention them all, but we probably won't get to go in depth with all of them. So I'll kind of let you pick and choose.
Okay. I think that it's important to note the first practice, because everything stems from that.
Yes.
And that is holding a posture of humility. And really what I mean by that is we need to go into every interaction, every conversation, every prayer with our hearts and minds recalibrated. And again, I'm saying this because I need this and because this does not come naturally to me. But what it does is it reminds us who we are and who God is. And when we do that, when we say, God, you are God and I am not, then we remember the order of things in the world, and we remember where we fit into it, and we also remember where our neighbor fits into it. Because we are image bearers of God, as are our neighbors. God is the God of all of humanity. And so when we enter into relationships with that posture, I have found things simply go better. I mean, really, just in a really practical way, things go better.
Yeah.
So that's where I start. And it's hard to put that into practical.
I get that, and I appreciate that. And I, you know, and probably one of the things that stopped me as I was looking through the chapter on holding a posture of humility was when I saw the subheading, a modern day foot washing. Because, you know, I think that's exactly what you're talking about. How do we keep this practical? You know, you're holding your real life experience in one hand and you're holding scripture in another hand. So how does scripture translate, you know, to us being loving our actual neighbor today? And I loved your story about a gal, her name was Kristen, who, you know, just saw this tired mom walking in the doors of the church, and she could have just said hi and passed her on by easily, because I think we do that Sunday in and Sunday out. See people that we realize we don't know, and we don't stop and introduce ourselves or even make note of what they might be needing in the moment. But talk a little bit about what Kristen did. Just she went above and beyond.
She did. Her job for that morning was to check kids into Sunday school. She saw a mom who came in that she did not recognize, with boys hanging from her. She was alone.
That boys hanging from her. Yeah.
Yes, right. Arriving at church with all of the stuff that is required for three children, and she didn't have another adult with her. And Kristen just took note of that And as she was doing her job, because she had some official duties of checking her in, she thought, I'm not just going to send her down the hall. I'm going to walk her to each classroom. Mm. So she did. And as she looked down, just she felt God kind of pressing her to look down. She noticed that this woman's shoe was untied. It's a very basic need. She also knew this woman can't bend down and tie her shoe because she has a child in her arms. She has a diaper bag on her arm. She's exhausted. So Kristen just asked, can I tie your shoe? And when she did, she looked up at the woman, and the woman was crying. Because I'm crying now.
Yes.
Because she felt seen. And, you know, this is not complicated. Kristen did not do anything that cost her very much,
yes,
except her pride. And it did not take her extra time necessarily or extra effort. She's an able-bodied woman, so it wasn't difficult for her to get down and do that. And yet it made such a difference in this woman's sense of welcome, because Kristen said, I'm not just going to go by my job description. I'm not just going to go by the things that have been bullet pointed for me to do by the church today. I am going to meet with this woman and meet her where she is. And what I think is interesting is Kristen latched on to the common ground that they had. Kristen had never had three boys. She doesn't know what that's like. She usually went to church with her husband. So she didn't know what it was like to walk into a church with three children alone.
Yep.
But she did know what it was like to be overwhelmed. Mm. And that's all she needed to find that common ground. And I think often we let those details be barriers to say, but I don't know what it's like to be that person. I don't know what it's like to be a grandmother. I don't know what it's like to have food stamps. I don't know what it's like, you know, just fill in the blank with anything. And we can let that be a barrier from taking that next step. Mm. But Kristen didn't. She said, I know the feeling behind it. And I think that's where we can connect with people.
That's
when
big.
We often feel like there's a difference.
That's big. Oh, I love that. Oh, I'm so glad I asked about that story. Thank you. One of the things that you do also in the book is at the end of each chapter, you have what is a call to Saturday living. And I love this, actually. This came back, I think, in the introduction as you talked about watching your husband out mowing the lawn. Mm-hmm. And someone came by and he turned the lawnmower off and engaged. And I so appreciated this. You said, I don't know if I could have done that. I would have had to have finished the row or maybe just waved and kept doing it. And I was thinking the same thing because I'm a little bit more, you know, type A, get task oriented, or I can be. And I think within that, maybe was part of the seed thought of a call to Saturday living. Say what it is you mean by that and the fact that you kind of include that at the end of each chapter.
So when I think of Saturdays and neighbors, they kind of go together. So we're outside a lot on Saturdays, especially, you know, it depends on time of year, but we're outside, we're interacting with people, you know, it's barbecue time, it's soccer sidelines kind of time. So there's that natural element of Saturday and neighbors. But as followers of Christ, we have this unique perspective on the world and on humanity's story. And living in the time that we do now, we know of Jesus' death and resurrection. And I think of the first disciples who didn't. They, you know, Good Friday, we call it Good Friday now because we know the good news of Sunday,
right?
But Friday, when Jesus died on the cross, was a very dark day for them. And they didn't have that knowledge of the Sunday hope, but we do. And we live embodied souls walking around this earth, tethered to the reality of sin in the world. So almost that Friday existence.
Mm-hmm.
Tethered to the pain and the grief, we experience it ourselves. Life is hard for many of us and for many of our neighbors. So we're tethered to that. We also are tethered to the hope that the resurrection brings, that Sunday good news, if you will. And so Saturday living is standing in the middle of that, being tethered to both and saying, I am not going to deny your pain, and I am not going to deny the hope. And the two can coexist, mm-hmm. and I am here for both. Mm. And so when we have this call for Saturday living, we're really saying, okay, let's take a posture of humility, for example. In this practice, I am going to be here for both, because both are involved. For humility, we have to know that we do not know everything about our neighbor's stories, about their life experiences, about the pain and the hurt that they've experienced. We don't know everything. We also don't know everything about God. Yeah. And so the posture of humility is being in the middle of both, and that is Saturday living. And so for each practice, we can say the reality of sin in the world is here. The reality of hope in humanity's story is also here.
You know, I love that on many levels, but I'm also going to offer this and see what you think. I think we can struggle to stand in that space with and for our neighbors, because I think that we have sometimes been, whether it's overt or covertly, taught that it shouldn't, life shouldn't be so hard. You know, do we really have this hope to offer our neighbors? And I think that some of us have kind of stopped holding that out because we're struggling in our own space. Mm-hmm. And so I appreciate that you're talking about it, because I think it is indeed very true. And we have not been promised this perfect life, but we have been indeed promised Christ's presence with us in the middle of this difficult space. And I think we sometimes need to talk about that. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I think a question we can ask ourselves over and over is, where is Jesus in this?
Yes.
And so whether it's somebody else's hard place or our hard place, because there's always an answer.
Yes, I agree with that. I think it's interesting to me. I think there are a lot of people that aren't asking that for themselves, and so therefore they're not holding it out, that hope out for someone else. And so I think that's a part of this process too, for some. Mm-hmm. For some. Mm-hmm. I love that practice. I mean, you have really explained it well, holding a posture of humility. Let's move on to another practice that you want to highlight.
Well, I will say, look, my favorite.
Yes.
Can I give you my favorite?
You can. I almost asked you your favorite. I know what my favorite is. I want to hear what yours is.
Okay. Well, it may be the same. And it is standing in the awkward.
Ah, okay.
Because this is the pivot point, I think, in relationships. Ah. Things get weird. They get uncomfortable.
Yes.
You have your first conflict, or you're starting the relationship in conflict, which is often the case with neighbors, right? We meet them when they're playing their music too loud, or their dog's barking. That would be me.
Totally, that was us.
Yeah. So when things get uncomfortable, we have a choice to stay in it or not. And that's why I called it standing in the awkward, because we're not leaving. We're not trying to escape, which is my natural tendency. I would rather have a conflict-free life. And that's my natural bent as a person of self-protection.
Preach on, yes.
Of comfortable. You know, think of all of the words, of the ways that we try to protect our lives. I want it to be safe. And I have intentionally made some choices in my parenting and where we live and that push that boundary, but it's not because it comes naturally to me. It's because I've had to have some intention in it. So when we are uncomfortable in a situation, I almost always think that the other person knows that and likely shares some discomfort too. And so when we stay and we stand in that place and say, okay, we still have to work this out, but I'm here for it, to work it out.
Yep.
Then what it tells the other person is, you are more important to me than my own comfort. And again, looking at the macro, I think if we all did that just a little bit more, took that little pivot, things culturally would be changing. And so I think, to me, that is such an important place for us to hang out, to stand, if you will.
Okay, so in this chapter, there are several things that happen in this chapter. you know, not the least of which is just showing up, which sometimes that can be the hardest thing. You know, you talk about that courage can be required. I love that you talk about Jesus and awkward moments because, I mean, he's lived it. It's not just stuff that comes to us that he has not lived himself. I also love that you have this section, questions to ask when persevering in the middle of standing in the awkward. And then probably my favorite story was with this kid, Tiger, who spit on the window of an establishment and was asked to never return. Okay, so I don't know what of those things I just mentioned you'd like to, you know, touch on. There's a lot there.
Let's talk about Tiger. Yeah. So he is not someone that I have met personally,
right.
But I knew someone else in the story who relayed the story to me. And so, as I mentioned, my husband works in affordable housing. He runs an organization here in Denver called Providence Network. And they partner with a group that walks Denver's streets called Dry Bones Denver. And their aim is to befriend homeless youth in Denver, which there are about 1,000 people between the ages of 14 and 24 on the streets every night in Denver. So their job is really, they see themselves as a relational ministry. So they often try to do events where young people can feel quote unquote normal or not like they're the outsiders. They're always the outsiders in every situation, whether they're on the bus, they just stand out and they feel like people are pushing them out.
Yeah.
So they try to create situations where they feel a sense of belonging because that's what we all want. So they were doing this coffee night and Robbie, who works for Dry Bones, is who's the one I know, was out talking to young people about, you know, come to this coffee shop where we'll buy you coffee every Friday night. I don't remember what night of the week it was. And you can come and we're going to hang out for 2 hours and it's okay because we're paying customers. We're going to pay for you. And this was a place that a lot of them had walked by and never been able to go in because they didn't have money to be customers. And so Tiger is one of these young men said, oh no, I can't ever go back there. And Robbie said, why? And he said, because I was in there once and I got in an argument with the owner. And on my way out, I went outside on the sidewalk. I looked back through the glass window of the coffee shop and I hacked a big loogie right on the window spit.
Yep.
And it just screamed down and he was so mad at me and he came out and he was yelling at me and he said, never come back here. He said, and I can't go back there. Well, Robbie knew the owner because they'd been arranging for this weekly coffee time. And so he approached him and said, you know, it sounds like Tiger did this. He says, because he asked Tiger, did you ever apologize? And he said, no. He said, he would like to come and apologize. Would that be okay with you? So Robbie acted as the broker.
Yep.
And the owner said, okay, I'll give it a second chance. So Tiger went in with Robbie. Robbie was the third party, neutral party, and it was very fast. Robbie said it was just all the tension was beforehand, and the moment itself went so quickly because Tiger said, I'm sorry, I won't do that again. And the owner said, okay, let's give it a second chance. That was it.
Wow.
Like, not a big sit-down mediation kind of moment. But all three of them had to be willing to be in the awkward in order for that to happen. And it was almost more uncomfortable beforehand than in the moment itself, right? Yeah. Which I think is so often the case. We get all worked up. I can't go have that conversation with that person because it's going to be weird. But then they open the door and they think, oh, this is going to be weird. So everyone's feeling the weirdness.
Yep.
And then you take that first step and everybody relaxes a little because you realize, wait, we're here not to argue, but to work it out. And Robbie was that great mediator, but all three of them were active participants in standing in the awkward. And Robbie is really good because he said, you know, we're in awkward situations a lot with these young adults because they don't have a lot of the social
skills.
Right.
Yes.
So they see things and do things that are uncomfortable. He said, we just call it out and say, I'm feeling a little funny right now about this. How about you? And I think that's such a great approach.
Really great.
To just call it out and then move forward. Like, wow, this is a little bit awkward.
And I think as I heard you telling the story, and I had read the story as well in the book, but I think even more as I heard you tell it, what came to my mind was love was present. People were embodying love toward another. Now, they might not have worded it that way, but they were willing to extend grace slash love, you know, whatever word. And, you know, in the bottom line, God was present here. And
right. And I think that's really important to note, because often as Christians, we think we have the monopoly on love and grace. And so we prevent ourselves. We, again, set those limits and say, I can't have that conversation because I'll extend grace because I know grace as it's described in my church setting. Mm-hmm. But to know that every good gift is from God. So every extension of grace stems from him at some point. So to know that our neighbors are able to participate in acts of forgiveness and grace.
Because they're image bearers, too.
Right.
And so, yes, I think this is a huge point. Love this.
So we don't need to limit our neighbor's ability, one, to love us back, mm-hmm. but also to participate in a reconciliation or forgiveness or grace process. They may not fit under that umbrella labeled Christian.
And I think, you know, really in essence what you're saying is we often limit God.
Yeah. Boom. Which gets back to the posture of humility.
Yes.
Right? Huh. God is God and I am not.
Oh, man. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All righty then. It all can start and end with that. But thankfully there are more practices. So, well, you know what? So I have to say that is one that I really liked, standing in the awkward, but one of my favorites was asking questions to learn. But here's the deal, though. It's because that comes second nature to me. Mm-hmm. I can ask a question. I can stand there and ask someone in the line at McDonald's, hey, what's your faith background? And not feel the least bit uptight or uncomfortable, and they don't either. It's just something that's, you know, whatever. I could ask any kind of question, and I could talk to a rock, you know, and have a good conversation. But what that said to me was, oh yeah, this is the one I gravitate toward, but I need to move toward the ones that I'm not as comfortable with. Mm-hmm. And I can do the standing in the awkward as well. I've had some experience with that, and I will press myself in part because I value relationship over the obstacle. It's like, I am pressing through this obstacle, by golly, and I'm going to do it sooner than later because I value relationship. So I've got to look at this list and go, okay, what's something that is harder for me to move toward that I need to look at? And so maybe, you know, we don't have the time to go into it, but just mention what the other practices are.
So you mentioned asking questions to learn, and the to learn is very key because we can use questions for lots of reasons.
What's our motivation?
They can be accusatory. They can be to catch someone.
Yep.
And so if we really don't care about their answers, then we're not really asking questions to learn.
Yes.
So really having a posture of curiosity is what follows this posture of humility. And then naturally, following asking questions to learn is being quiet to listen. But, you know, you talked about spiritual practices, and I do quote Adele Calhoun in the book, as I have in my other books.
Yes.
But this idea of practicing quiet on our own, apart from other people, prepares us to be better listeners when we are face-to-face with people. And so it is not just a practice that we are doing in conversation, though that is true. We cannot listen to other people if we're talking. But we also need to be more in tune with the Holy Spirit. And the way to do that is to spend time in quiet alone. Now, as an introvert, I don't have a problem with that.
Me too. Yeah.
Other people, it's a struggle, and the struggle is real. And then also, I do know the struggle is real as a person who lives with five other people.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. You know, practicing quiet alone in solitude, they're not, you right. have to be intentional about them.
Yes.
So that can be stage of life and life circumstances.
Absolutely.
And then the practice of accepting what is. Mm. And we did touch on this some about, you know, our neighbors are different than us often. I mean, really, they all are, because every person's different than us right. in some way. And we sometimes go into relationships with an agenda. We may not realize even that we have one.
That's a great point.
I would
point.
Say a lot of my agendas, I don't realize until I'm in the middle of it and
good
think,
point.
This gets to expectations. Oh, I thought it was going to go this way.
Right.
Because I wanted it to.
Yes.
And it's not going this way. So I'm feeling disappointment or frustration or anger.
That's good.
But accepting our neighbor's circumstances often is difficult for us. We want to fix people's problems.
Yeah.
Accepting who they are as people, because we think God wouldn't make someone to either behave that way, believe that way, think that way. And I have, again, the monopoly on what's right. So that always gets us back to the posture of humility. But to accepting what is, what that does is that gives us freedom.
Yes.
To enjoy people. To be in relationship. To be loved by our neighbors. Mm. This is meant to be a mutual loving, not a project.
Yeah.
And so when we...
You say that one again. That's like a really big that needs to be heard.
Yes, this is meant to be a mutual loving. Not a project. Yes.
Whew,
so
okay.
When we accept that there are things about our neighbors that will not change, that we don't have the authority to change, that we don't even have the authority to speak into, we can enjoy those relationships that much more. And that gets us to the practice that I personally find the most difficult, which is lightening up. And I got this word of wisdom from a conversation, you know, I met with people in the Denver metro area that I think love people well. And I got it from a fellow writer that I suspect you know, and that is Patricia Raybon.
Oh, sure. Yes.
And if you know her, she I wouldn't say she's like a fun-go-lucky kind of personality. She, like me, tends to think about heavy things, serious things, deep things. But she's also a very self-aware woman. And she said, you know, sometimes, especially as Christians, we can go heavy really fast, and we can make everything about somebody's salvation, or we can make everything. She maybe didn't say that, but
you know what? She probably did. And you are so right.
But she said, we can make things really big and heavy when really we just need to laugh with our neighbors about the fact that somebody's dog pooped in our yard or whatever,
yes,
something
totally.
Really dumb and silly.
I wear a bracelet that says, remember to play, because like it's kind of not on the top of my list, you know, and
right.
I had to work at that. I totally get this.
So
I
part
love
of that's personality.
Yep.
And
yep.
Part of it is just the burdens. This is the Saturday living part, right? Part of it is the burdens we carry around.
Yeah.
And the other day I was at Target
yeah.
and I don't know why this guy who worked there seemed so carefree to me. And I thought, he was in his 20s probably. Do you not have people to care for? Do you not have bills to pay? Do you not? We're at the stress in your life. I was projecting all of my own heavy, heavy stress.
You wanted him to feel
yes.
stressed.
And
that's
thinking,
hilarious.
And so I had this process, this thought process of, is that what it is to be really living in freedom?
Mm.
Is to feel less burdened? Mm. Not necessarily. Right? Because like you said, God didn't promise us this carefree life.
Right.
However, he also didn't say that life is meant to be torture.
Yes.
And sometimes we act as if it is.
Yes.
And how is that going to be fun for our neighbors?
That's
if
so
we're
good.
Walking around
that's
saying
so
joyless
important.
Torture is life.
Yes, that's so important. I might be one of the, I don't know, you said many very important things today, but that's one of them that I definitely have to take to heart, and I think many of us do. Whew. Okay, carry
so
on here.
So that's the practice I have the most trouble with. And then the last one is giving freely.
Hmm.
And I will say sometimes as the church, especially if we are in a program mode or organizationally, we lead with this. Where we say, and I just know this from my husband's work, you know, that we want to give money. We want to fix things. Right? Like
yeah.
we're going to come into a community and we're going to fix.
Yeah.
And we're going to give because our intentions are good.
Yeah.
And I don't want to ever knock down somebody's feeling of compassion.
Yes.
Generosity.
Yep.
And well-meaning intentions. However.
Yeah.
We often are doing more harm by leading with giving than by doing the other practices first, which is being humble, asking questions to learn, being quiet to listen, to hear what people actually need, being in the uncomfortable with them, accepting what we cannot change, having kind of a mutual, fun, loving relationship. And then we give. Then we give out of this knowledge of who our neighbors are and what they need, and this mutuality where we recognize we are not your saviors swooping in the Christian church to meet your needs, but we are here to do life with you, and we have some things we can offer you, but you have some things that we can benefit from.
Yes.
And so that's why I think it is so interesting that God put this here at the end of this generous love, is how it's stated in Scripture, in those verses in 2 Peter, that we end with generous love. And that's what my friend Karen was talking about. It's like you build this foundation so that when you are loving your neighbor, it is built on something of who they are and who God is in their lives.
Yes, and yes. I have to say, one of the things I've not mentioned is there are wonderful discussion questions at the end of each chapter. I already sent a copy, or I sent a picture of this book to one of my pastors and said, oh yeah, this, I knew she would love this, and I said this would be a wonderful small group study, especially when our church has the tagline of love, loving God, loving neighbor, or love God, love neighbor. You know, the name of the book is Loving My Actual Neighbor, Alexandra Kuykendall. Got that right. And man, this was chock full of things in the podcast, the book even more so. And Alexandra, thank you so much for taking the time and being with me here on Faith Conversations today.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's my joy.
And to everyone else, there's lots here. I say keep the conversation going.